Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Welcome back to Dark Florida. I'm your host, Brooke Moreland. Before we dive in, I'll be speaking at Charlie's Beyond Belief Expo in Fort Myers, Florida on October 18th. I'm so excited. I hope I get to see you there and would love to be able to connect with you. I will have a booth, so please feel free to come up and say hi, and I will also have a couple of goodies to give away. And as always, you can connect with me and support the show on Instagram at Dark Florida Podcast. And if you have a creepy story to share or would like to be a guest on the show, you can reach out to me at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/@darkflorida411. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida. And wherever you're listening, be sure to drop a 5-star review and share the show with a friend. It really helps. Tonight's episode takes us deep into a chilling chapter of Florida's past. This is a classic true crime story, one that feels like it's been pulled from the yellowed pages of an old newspaper, complete with mystery, violence, and whispers of organized crime. This is old world Florida at its darkest. So settle in, turn down the lights, and let's step back in time to uncover the story of the madman. Welcome back to Dark Florida. Tonight on Dark Florida, we're diving into a chilling, forgotten case that once gripped the nation and shattered a small Florida Gulf Coast community. Our guest is M.F. Gross, a Florida-based author and historian whose latest book, Madman, uncovers the shocking 1949 Crystal Beach murder, the troubled life of John Calvin Russell, and the haunting questions that still linger to this day. M.F. Gross has a gift for bringing neglected pieces of Florida history back into the light and blending deep research with storytelling that pulls you straight into the past. From the shadows of a Chattahoochee state hospital to whispers of organized crime to a daring escape from the Pinellas County Jail, his work shines a light on the dark corners of our state's history. Welcome, M.F. Gross, to Dark Florida. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thanks, Brooke. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited. I mean, this case happened right in my backyard. I'm also a Tampa Bay resident. So when I read your book, it felt like I was going back in time, and it really took me to that old Florida.
That's great. That's exactly what I intended. That's similar to the process I went through when writing the book. It was almost like time travel.
Yeah. Yeah. And I loved all the old pictures too for reference. When I got to that point, I was like, this is so cool. But for the listeners who maybe aren't familiar with you and your work, can you just give us an overview of the story and the crime that's at the heart of this?
Sure. The crime of Rastus Russell and the whole story is about a murder that took place in 1949. It took place in Crystal Beach, Florida, which is on the West Coast of Florida in the Tampa Bay area, of course, right here. Crystal Beach is a tiny little corner of Palm Harbor in North Pinellas County, the area. It's just north of Clearwater. And in 1949, it was a quiet little village. Everyone knew each other. Rastus Russell, who was kind of a local ruffian, ne'er-do-well, very familiar to local police, but he was primarily just a burglar and car thief. He didn't have anything like murder on his record. And for some reason, which we explore in the book, he showed up at the home of some senior citizens in Crystal Beach, and it turned into a very bloody and macabre scene that eventually involved five different victims.
A little bit about Russell. When I read his background, it seemed like he had a really seedy past. I mean, he was in and out of courthouses that seemed like he had had some crimes, nothing quite this major, and also spent some time in that Chattahoochee hospital, which I guess was not necessarily the best place to have your mental health treated in that time. Do you think that maybe his stays there worsened his condition overall?
Well, I don't know if it worsened his condition, but it certainly was not a pleasant place to be. In Chattahoochee State Hospital in the 1980s, conditions were horrific, to say the least. And a lot of people escaped from there. And Russell himself actually escaped from there and for some reason was never returned. He was just... They never pursued him, and he was just out after that. But he had been in and out. He had been to Chattahoochee a couple times, and he swore he would never go back. He would rather die than go back there. And actually spent some time in and out of prisons, also spent some time in a mental institution in Illinois. So he was no stranger to the system.
Yeah, it certainly seems like there's a potential he could have been stopped sooner if he was properly dealt with by our system. But at that time, it just isn't as sophisticated as it is today.
Yeah, they didn't have the treatment options that they have today. Russell was actually sent to the home for feeble-minded when he was 10 years old as a child. So he had problems early. And it's strange because he was not your typical, he wasn't mentally ill like he was wandering around the streets babbling to himself. I mean, by most accounts, he was a very good-looking, muscular, charismatic guy. And what a lot of the studied or the people that studied him back then and interviewed him concluded was he had a condition which they called at the time Jekyll and Hyde syndrome, where he could be sane most of the time and then just like a light switch could flip and he could just go crazy. And that appears to have played a role in what happened in Crystal Beach in 1949.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, what got you first looking into this case? How did you come across this and decide to write the book?
Well, I lived in Crystal Beach for 12 years. And one day I was happened to pick up a book on the history of Crystal Beach. And it was written by a lot of the old time residents there. They just local people each contributed a chapter talking about something they remember from their childhood growing up there in the 40s and 50s. And most of it was this idyllic going to picnics and scalloping off the shore and things like that. But among those stories, I came across one of a much darker nature. And it was a story by a lady by the name of Linda Henry. And Linda relayed a story of this Rastus Russell murder. And when she was a six-year-old girl was when it happened. And she remembers walking up to this house the day after the murders and looking in the window. And she says, all as I remember is the blood. There was blood everywhere. And there was a smell that came with it. And I've never forgotten that smell. Even to this day, when she walks back there, she said she smells that smell. And for that reason, she doesn't walk back there anymore. And I said, that sounds like one of the creepiest things I've ever heard. And from that point forward, I started digging into this story and just became fascinated with it. Never set out to be a true crime writer, just became fascinated with this story. And the deeper I dug and the more I found out about it, I said, this is just a story that has to be told. It's that fascinating. It plays like a movie. And we got the book from that.
It definitely does play like a movie. And especially some of the photos that are in your book from the scene, they really do look like something out of a movie out of that time, especially when, not to spoil it, but when they capture him, the one where he's coming out of the water, that just looks like something off of a movie set right there. But I was wondering how the residents of the area took to this, because you got to think this happened back in August 1949. And it was just a different time then. People weren't exposed to the level of crime and violence like we are today. And we turn on the news and we see it everywhere. And it was a much more trusting time. Everybody knew everybody. So for a crime this heinous to happen in a small Gulf Coast community, that must have really shook Pinellas County at that time.
It did. To a person, the people I interviewed that were alive then, and most of them were children, they almost universally described it as terrified. And they all remember stories of being sent to their bedrooms, being locked, of dad sitting on the front porch with a shotgun. Some of their older siblings were out in the woods participating in the manhunts, armed, of course. You have to remember, Brooke, this was right after World War II, and the country was very much united. Communities were much more united then, and everybody knew each other. And you'll see in the book how the community really comes together as a whole to hunt this guy down and find him, and how much they, the police and the community really seem to work together. There doesn't seem to be as much separation as there is today. Those lines are blurred somewhat, but it's interesting how they did it.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought so too. I thought that there were a lot of moving pieces, especially as he's making his way around the Tampa Bay area and kind of crossing jurisdictions there at a few points.
Yeah, what's fascinating is, although the whole entire community, I mean, the whole Tampa Bay area, Central Florida, is looking for this guy. This was big news. This was national news. It was almost like the Manson murders at the time. It was that spectacular. And you know, there was roadblocks up. Even then, Courtney Campbell Causeway was newly opened. They blocked off all the entrances to Pinellas County. So people couldn't get in and out of the county without going through these roadblocks, supposedly. And yet Russell manages to elude capture for many days and goes back and forth between Tampa and Hillsborough County. And it's just amazing how he is able to stay one step ahead of the law on the run with all these people looking for him.
No, that is fascinating. And I think one of the fascinating parts about your book, too, is the theories. I know the motives for the murders. The main theme is a potential robbery gone wrong. Like, he was there, had a seated past, wanted some money, but he has some connections to what appears to be perhaps organized crime. He didn't live in Florida for the entirety of his life. It looks like he did move around from several states, like you said, picking up a record in those places and getting sent to prison and so on and so forth. What is the organized crime angle of this that really roped you in? And I saw that you had some of your own alternative theories for the case.
Yeah, that's a good observation in the book. You know, the way it was reported in the news at the time was that the Browns were just this innocent couple that Russell happened to stop by their house randomly at 6:30 one morning and murdered them. But the real story is a lot deeper than that. First of all, Russell, by his and Ann Brown's admission, had been to their house before, 2 months prior. And why he was there, Ann Brown changes the story why he was there three times, which is suspicious in and of itself. Then when he does show up at their house, he spends 3.5 hours sitting at their kitchen table talking, having coffee. Now, if you're there to kill and rob somebody, why would you spend 3.5 hours sitting at their kitchen table having coffee with them? In addition, Ann Brown claims afterwards, she, of course, survived the attack. She claims she didn't know his name. So this guy's supposedly been to their house 2 months earlier. Now he's there. He spends 3.5 hours at their house having coffee, and she doesn't know his name. It starts to sound suspicious, and didn't say anything suspicious in the papers. But when I started interviewing the old-time residents, they all floated some version of the same rumor that the Browns owed money. They owed money to someone, whether it was Rastus Russell, whether it was someone Rastus Russell was acting on behalf of. That part is unclear. My theory, from what I turned up, my theory is Russell acted on his own. I don't think he had any concrete ties to organized crime. I think he may have said that to make people think he was more important than he was. But there never seemed to be any of that in any of the investigations. He was arrested in Illinois, did some time for car theft, maybe was involved with some people, but there's no evidence that anything he did here had anything to do with organized crime, even though that's something he told everybody at the time.
Right. Yeah, I think the inconsistencies and some of the key details of the story really stood out. And I think it was on a couple of different key players who were involved too, especially the girl who he might have been seeing at the time, allegedly, perhaps kidnapped. We're not clear on that piece of it too. Even her involvement, Dorothy, it's a little shrouded in mystery there too. So it seems like maybe not as cut and dry, but there definitely seems, like you said, that they met before, under what circumstances still remain unknown to this day.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about this story is a lot of stories you have the good guy and the bad guy, and you know them clearly. In this story, there's a lot of shades of gray, and you're not really sure who's clean and who isn't. You brought up the Dorothy Jean Crane and the Crane family. That's a fascinating angle to this story because he lived with the Crane family, and they were just, you know, they worked at an orange processing plant. They were hardworking people. They were just family, you know, raising a family in Pinellas County at the time. And at the same time, Russell spent by either a couple weeks or a couple months living with them. It's hard to say if they knew about, I mean, this wasn't Russell's only crime. He was involved in a lot of things, like I said, mostly burglary and assault type things. But did any of them know he was friends with the older brothers? Did they know, or did they do any of these things with them? And then he did a murder and that was like too much for them. It's hard to say. We examine that in the book. We look at the role of Dorothy. Did Dorothy know about any of this stuff? Granted, she was only 16. Wasn't a lot she could do about it, even if she did. But just some interesting angles. I'm convinced from my point as the author, as the person that researched this, that the Browns were somehow involved with this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, especially because, like you said, we're talking about the 1940s here. Close-knit community, you don't just stumble upon Crystal Beach by accident. It seems very deliberate. And now, when we talk about some of these gaps, maybe lying by omission, do you think that that was a result of the fear, maybe trauma, or that perhaps some of these key players were deliberately leaving out those details?
Well, Ann Brown was the only witness to what he did, at least the first part of the crime. Russell showed up at their house. He ties them both to their beds, spread eagle in the bedroom, and then proceeds to torture them with a knife and the butt of a shotgun because he thinks there's money in the house. Why he is so convinced of that goes back to, could they be involved? But Ann Brown, yes, she gives different versions of the story, and some of the details with her get kind of fudged. And you have to wonder, is she covering something up when she tells her story? The Cranes as well. There's a lot of inconsistencies in the way Sam Crane tells the story of how Russell Cranes eventually turn him in. They set him up to be captured. But there's a lot of inconsistencies into how that comes about. And that's one of the things that gets tied into the story. Who really knows what and who is only saying what they want people to really know?
Right. It kind of leads to the bigger question of the why, for sure. And it makes you wonder, at his death, what secrets did he take to his grave?
If only we knew. Russell did one interview with the media, and that was the only one we ever got from him. But one of the most interesting things to come out of that interview is they asked him at one point, did you know the Browns, the murder victims? And he said, yes, I knew them. And they asked if he'd been to the house before. And he said, yes. And he said, there's a lot of things I could say, but I'm not going to say anything else until I talk to my attorney. And we have to wonder, almost like Lee Harvey Oswald, if he would have got to the point where we could have got him in a courtroom, what he would have said, the truths he would have revealed, were they involved and how?
Yeah, absolutely. That is a really ominous quote by him. And you do have to wonder what exactly he meant by that, because that really changes it from a crime of passion or opportunity to something a little bit deeper. If you could speak directly to one figure in this case, whether it be Russell, the Browns, maybe somebody from the Crane family, or even an investigator, what would you want to ask them?
Probably going back to that question. How did you know the Browns? How were you involved with them? Why were you so convinced there was money in the house that day? Russell was, you know, it's an interesting thing that he's portrayed as a monster. And even the people that remember him as a monster. And yet the one person I interviewed that had actually met him was one of the Cranes. He was one of the Crane boys. And now he's almost 90 now, but he's still alive. And he clearly remembers Rastus Russell. And I said, did he come off that way? Was he mean? How was he in real life? And he said, he was one of the nicest guys I ever met. He said he around the house, he was good natured. He helped around the house, laughed. He told jokes. He ate dinner with us. He never would have expected. And I think it goes back to that Jekyll Hyde personality thing. But that he would definitely be the person I would want to ask those questions to, because I think that's the core of the story.
And I find it really fascinating how many jail escapes he had, as well as escapes from state hospitals. Do you think that his escape really exposed some weaknesses in the county jail system at that time?
Absolutely, yeah. And Chattahoochee as well. He escaped Chattahoochee. A lot of criminals escaped Chattahoochee. But he definitely, you know, at the time, the Pinellas County Jail was in downtown Clearwater. And they were actually in process of building a new jail right across the street. And that's where, if you know where, well, this would be for local listeners, but if you know where the Clearwater Courthouse is today, the building right beside that, which is now an administrative building, that was originally the new jail that was being built at the time Russell escaped. And for just those reasons, although it still wasn't easy to escape from that jail, there were so many things that lined up that night in perfect coordination that allowed him to escape. I think it probably pointed out some systematic flaws, but it was really the fault of the jailer who just didn't follow procedure.
Right. And it's interesting how many little details there are like that in his story, where just one thing happened where it seemed, for lack of a better term, like he had luck on his side and was just able, like you said, I think earlier, was able to stay like a couple steps ahead of law enforcement the entire time up until his unfortunate demise.
Well, yeah. And it's funny because Russell, yeah, he's an escape artist, but when you read his history and how many times he was arrested and how many times he was either freed or escaped and not pursued, you have to start wondering, was there an invisible hand guiding him somewhere or helping him along the way? There's even speculation when he was on the run, there was people around Pinellas County helping him. And there is a rumor that I also came across that Russell had friends in high places. Crystal Beach rumor has it that nobody ever knew who Russell's father was. Crystal Beach's rumor has it that Russell's father was a high-ranking judge in Pinellas County. And that led me to speculate that maybe that's why things happened to work in Russell's favor that we couldn't see.
Right. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with MK Ultra at all. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard it, but no.
So when you talk about kind of hidden hand, my mind just thinks about some things that were happening back in that time. Now, MKUltra was basically this covert CIA project that spanned across several jails, psychiatric institutions, as well as colleges, universities, and things like that back in the 1950s. Now, supposedly, MKUltra officially operated from 1953 until 1973, and it had a really dark history associated with it. For example, some of these women who had been committed for postpartum, because back in the day, they didn't understand mental health like we do today and understand that, you know, after childbirth, that women can go through a severe depression, you know, and have suicidal thoughts and tendencies and things. So a lot of times they were just committed to state hospitals and almost like thrown away the key. Well, what was happening in these state hospitals, as you pointed out with Chattahoochee, were really dark and had some pretty skeevy stuff happening. Well, basically, MKUltra tested LSD and secretly dosed people. And it was part of a mind control operation to see how it affected people. So, of course, they preyed on innocent people with limited rights. When you're in the state hospital, you're kind of ward of the state. Same thing when you go to prison, you are at the mercy of the state. And they tested on these subjects, oftentimes without their knowledge. So it's interesting you say that, because it reminds me, you brought up Manson. He kind of has a similar story too, about how he got arrested and would seemingly be let go, get arrested, get let go, almost like someone behind the scenes was pulling the strings and making it happen. So you do wonder if it's tied into this seedy underbelly that was happening in our country at the time.
That's a fascinating theory. And I could see how it would play right into that too, because he, like I said, he'd been in and out of institutions since he was 10 years old. So you don't know who we could have encountered during that time, if there was some type of covert program going on. It would make sense.
Yeah, It is really interesting. You just never know. But was there a moment in your research that you felt like you were uncovering something that no one had looked at in decades?
Yeah, there was. I think probably the part about the theory about the Browns being involved somehow, nothing I had read in my research ever hinted at that. That was purely by interviewing people that were alive then that relayed that theory to me. When I interviewed Wilburn Crane, Russell lived with his family, as I mentioned before. Crane told me a story that his father had told him after the Russell saga concluded, that the Browns had actually owned a jewelry store somewhere up in New York. And 2 months earlier, when Russell had come to the house, they had hired him to rob the jewelry store, take the jewels, bring them to the Browns, and the Browns would reimburse him with insurance money. And apparently Russell did his part. He gave him the jewels, and the Browns either didn't or couldn't pay. And that's why he was there that morning, to collect what was owed him. And when it wasn't given, he believed it was there somewhere, and he tied them up and tortured them until they gave him his cut. And we don't know. For all we know, Dan Brown gave up the money. We would never know if it did happen. But coming from that source, you've got to give it some weight. So
absolutely. That's a fascinating theory. I mean, that would certainly explain, you have a mentally unstable individual who has that Jekyll and Hyde personality, who seems to flip a switch and be a completely different person. And you put him in a sensitive situation where he believes he deserves something. I think that's enough to set him off.
It is. And it also fits because the Browns were having financial trouble. They were selling their house. Mrs. Brown was actually going back to work. She had just got a job had an interview in St. Petersburg the next day scheduled. And these people are retired, and she's going back to work just to make ends meet. So they were definitely having some financial trouble. So why this guy would show up at the house demanding money from people that are in financial distress, that doesn't add up either. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those questionable details in the story. I do have to ask, because on my show, not only do I dig into eerie true crime, but I dabble with the paranormal. So I know that the original house has been since torn down, if I read that correctly, that it no longer stands. Now, you said that one of the residents goes by and still kind of has that PTSD moment, smells the blood and the carnage from that day. That's could obviously be a trauma response to that area. But have you heard of any reports of paranormal activity in or around the house where that happened, or even maybe where he ultimately lost his life in Thonisassa?
Yeah, I love that angle, Brooke. You're the first person that's asked me that, so I'm glad you did.
Cool.
I read in one of the old magazines that used to write this up, that the people that lived there afterwards had reported that, you know, there was paranormal activity in the house. Now, the thing is, that house sat vacant for 20 years before anyone moved into it after the murder. It sat abandoned. It was your stereotypical haunted house. It sat back off in the woods by itself. Brush was overgrown. The house was dilapidated. And the people that remember growing up in the 1950s as children told me that was the house you dared your friends to go back to at night. They all thought it was haunted. Everybody was afraid of it. And one gentleman described when you walked past it, it was like whistling by the graveyard. So it had a well-known reputation. And it's surprising that somebody bought that house 20 years later and lived in it for a while. It didn't get demolished until the late 90s.
Yeah, that's interesting. Makes you wonder why.
Yeah, I thought about that too. You know, I went back there when I was just looking over the site. It's developed now, but the place where the house sat is kind of like a backyard area where there's trees. And I the lot next to it, they just dug that lot up because they built a new house there. And when they were digging it up, I went through with permission of the owner and was just rooting around in the dirt, just hoping to find maybe a piece of wood or something from that house to tie it back to it. But yeah, I know what you mean there. I think visiting these places where the murder took place, where Russell was killed, I've been there, and I believe you can feel it still there. And that sounds a little, I don't know what you want to call it, spiritual, paranormal, but I just believe, knowing what happened there, and maybe it's just because of my closeness to the material, but I believe you can feel it still there.
No, I'm a firm believer in that too. And that's a concept I explore on my show a lot too, or some of these places that still hold that residual energy from the dark things that happened there. And so the site in which he was killed, has that been developed or is that still a field? I know that Florida, unfortunately, right now is incredibly overdeveloped and is not the same landscape that it was back in 1949. Is this place still stand or did they put a development over it?
Actually, no. It's it's still a field. It's a strawberry field now. And it's over in Sonoma, Sassa. It was an orange grove and swamp at the time, but they grow strawberries there now. But Sonoma, Sassa is very much like it was in the 1940s. It's still very rural, beautiful place, but very rural there. And the graveyard where Russell's mother is buried and likely Russell himself is buried, that has a feel. It's like an old, old graveyard. And, you know, Russell supposedly stood in front of that grave of his mother the night before he was killed. And I stood there in that spot and just, yeah, there's a feeling there too. So, and his ashes are supposedly buried there right beside his mother. So yeah, there's a feeling there for sure.
That has to be a cool moment as a historian and an author to go and stand in the places where they stood and be in those moments and to feel what they felt. So, and it's okay if you don't want to talk about it on air, but is this graveyard here in Florida?
Yeah, it's in Sonoma, Sassa. It's this Sonoma, Sassa Cemetery, and it's still there. I mean, it's an old cemetery, but it's still open to the public and you can walk through there. But yeah, I think that was my favorite part of writing the book is visiting the actual locations, because you write on feel. Writing's about feelings. And if you don't, you have to feel those feelings yourself so you can make other people feel them.
Well, I know I certainly enjoyed reading your book. I might be a little biased being a Tampa Bay resident myself, but hearing the stories as you told it from that time, it took me back in time because some of these landmarks still stand. You talk about the Bay Pines Hospital that is still here in St. Pete and these different locations, old US 19 and been Dunedin. And like you talked about the old jail and those types of things. And it's really cool. It really feels honestly like you're going back in time to old Florida. And I loved all of the references to the orange groves as they were at the time and just how untouched it felt in that point in time in our history. It was really, really cool.
Yeah, a lot of the buildings where much of this stuff happened are still standing, and we do highlight them in the book, kind of a then and now thing. And at the risk of doing some self-promotion, Brooke, I am giving a live presentation of this book to Crystal Beach residents. Well, actually, it's open to the public. It's open to everybody, but it's at the Crystal Beach Community Center on October 17th. And afterwards, we are going on a Rastus Russell / ghost tour of Crystal Beach, where we're going to visit some of the actual locations from the book. And it's going to conclude at the actual murder site. And I'm going to speak a little bit at each site. So you are certainly welcome to attend that, as are your listeners.
My goodness. And you said that's October 17th?
October 17th at 6:30. At the Crystal Beach Community Center.
You know, I actually have a speaking engagement in Fort Myers on the 18th, so I am regrettably going to miss that, but that sounds so cool. I wish I could attend because that's right up my alley, and that is so cool that you're doing that. I'll be sure to put that in the show notes so that way people can come and support you and see your presentation on that. What part of Russell's story do you think that the listeners will find the most haunting? And what do you hope your readers take away from Mad Men? Are you hoping for maybe sympathy for Russell, outrage at the system, or something else?
Well, that's a good question. It's hard to say the part I found the most haunting, because the part I find most haunting may not be the part your readers feel most haunting. But I think the actual step-by-step of the murder itself in the bedroom, the torture murders, is just so disturbing. It's so unsettling. And I'm probably a little immune to it now because I've written about it and studied it so much. But I remember in my initial research just thinking, God, this is just horrible, you know, and writing it. I think that's probably the most haunting part of the book, especially when you see the photos. As far as what I want readers to take away, there's no one point I want them to come away with. I want readers to come away feeling like they just went watched the best thriller movie they ever watched, and they did it through a book. That's what I want, because that's what it was to me. It's not just people think, well, it's this crime. The crime's just the beginning of the story. And this story morphs into this twisted love story and prison escape. And there's this cat and mouse chase through the swamps of Florida. And it's almost like an adventure story. And then it ends in this very gratifying ending, which we won't give away here, but it's conclusive. So I want readers to come away feeling like they just experienced a really great story and felt like they just watched a movie.
I think they certainly will. Like echoing what I had said previously, it really does feel like you're going back in time and like you're reliving the story through the 1940s lens, which is incredible. It was an excellent book, and I recommend that everybody go out and get yourself a copy. Now, you said you never started out to be a true crime author. Now that you've kind of uncovered this story, which I'm surprised this is the first time I'm hearing about this, because a crime like this is like we were talking about. This is like Manson, Bundy level crime. And it really is almost that true crime theater with just the twists and turns that this story really takes and how graphic the crimes were that took place. Do you plan on looking into any more of Dark Florida's history, or what's next for you as an author in now true crime?
I'm already working on the second book, Brooke, and it's going to be hopefully as good or not better than the first.
Very cool.
Do you want me to give it away here or not?
That's up to you. I would, of course, love for you to share as much as you're willing to.
Well, it's definitely Dark Florida, and you probably heard this story. It is the story of Victor Licata, who was the 21-year-old man that in 1933 in Ybor City took an axe and killed every member of his family in the house. The reasons, there's been so much written about it because it eventually led to the criminalization of marijuana in Florida, actually in the United States, but it was held up as one of the key cases. And actually, as time went on, it came to pass that Licata probably never even smoked marijuana, but that had nothing to do with it at the time. But it's not about that. What there's been a lot written about that angle. My angle is going to be exactly like the same angle as Madman, where we're actually going to go back and put the reader in 1933 in Ybor City and take them through the actual story itself, just like this one, without really the political angle, just the, and it's every bit as fascinating as Madman. So I'm going to have fun writing it. That's for sure.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, we'll definitely have to have you back on once that's published to be able to promote that and share a little bit more about it. I'm really looking forward to it. I know that it will be just as detailed rich as Madman is. And I can't wait. Ybor is another one of the cities with such a rich history. And I love that authors like yourself are shining a light on the Sunshine State and the history that we do have, although it seems sometimes like it's forgotten. It's just always lurking in the shadows.
Yeah, there's a lot here to unpack in our state. And yeah, I look forward to doing it. It sure is a lot of fun.
Certainly is. I just want to thank you so much for coming on tonight and give you an opportunity to, where can people find your work? Where can people get themselves a copy of your book and anything that you'd like to plug?
Sure. Yeah, you can get a copy of Madman. It's on almost all major retailers, Amazon, of course. It's also available on audio. We got, if anybody listening has watched the television show Scandal, we got actor George Newbern to narrate the book, and the audiobook is fantastic. We talked about it sounded like a movie. It's about as close to a movie as you can get. George did a great job with it. The audiobook is currently available on Spotify. It should be up on Amazon any day now. We're going through the approval process, but it should be up any day. So, but it's brand new. It's out. It's great. If you prefer to read, it's on Kindle, or you can order the hard copy book, either one. But Amazon or any of the other major retailers, best place to go. If you want the audio right now, today, Spotify is probably the best place.
Awesome. That's incredible.
And also my website, mfgross.com. We also have bonus content there. We have a lot of stuff that wasn't in the book, photographs, video clips, things like that. So be sure to visit me there too.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again for coming on. I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and I really enjoyed your book and just going back in time into Tampa Bay.
Thanks, Brooke. I'm glad you had me on your show. You have a really cool podcast here.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining me on this journey into Florida's forgotten shadows. And if you enjoyed this episode, I'd love to connect and keep the conversation going. Be sure to give us a follow on Instagram at Dark Florida Podcast, and feel free to email me at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com and subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/@darkflorida411. And you can support the show at buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida. And remember, if you have had your own strange encounter or eerie story, reach out. I'd love to hear it and maybe even feature it on the show. Until next time, keep looking into the dark corners of Dark Florida. Stay curious and stay strange.